The following is presented as an entertainment program emphasizing folklore. It is not intended as legal or medical advice in any way and should not be used to replace the advice of a legal or medical professional. A brief note. Hi, everyone. You can already probably tell that this month I missed getting the notebook out on time. I apologize for that. By way of explanation, I just moved house and I had final grading for the semester, and it all happened kind of in the same two-week period. And my priorities just sort of shifted to get those things taken care of before I could dive into finishing and recording this episode. And I'm not trying to use that just as an excuse, but I just hope that you understand. I also know that that means that the lunar forecast is not really as helpful this month because it's happening almost halfway through it. So I've abbreviated it in this episode, which will help me get this out a little bit faster as well, since I can just kind of work on this and knock it out. I'll be focusing on just the new and full moons and any significant astro events worth noting, which really nothing this month. And then I'll dive in, do the rest of the notebook, be pretty much the same from there. So hopefully we'll be back on track for a regular notebook in that first week of June. So be watching for that. And thank you so much for your patience. Now on with the show. Hello and welcome to the New World Witchery Folk Magician's Notebook, episode for May 2026. These are short monthly episodes that will offer a brief overview of folk magical topics and information that might be useful to you over the coming month. We highly recommend that you also pick up a reliable almanac for folk magic, such as the Witch's Almanac, Llewellyn's Astrological Pocket Planner, the Ritual Daily Planner, or your local Farmer's Almanac. Let's take a look at the moon for May 2026. Our new moon will be on May 16th, and it will be in the sign of Taurus. This will make it an ideal time for doing any work with grounding, cleansing, or protecting your space or your body. One of the exercises I recommended in my New World Witchery book has to do with finding your quote-unquote witch's mark and reclaiming it, and this would be an ideal new moon for that. Embrace the parts of you that are unique, different, special, or even mark yourself using a makeup marker or jewelry, or feel that power of reclaiming your own body as a magical space as you go through the rest of the month. It's also a good time for some magical cookery or even just enjoying some magical foods. The full moon is on the 31st in Sagittarius, and some would consider it a blue moon since we had a previous full moon running from Walpurgisnacht into the 1st of May. Regardless of how you see it, it's definitely a time to work with the energies of fate and fortune. If you have talismans or luck charms that you want to charge, this is the moon to do that. Lay them in the moonlight, or simply capture some of that moonlight in some water or reflecting in the wax of a candle, and then sprinkle the talisman or pass it over slash through slash around the flame to give it some of that Sagittarian full moon energy. In the cards. Each month, I'll pull a card from a tarot and a playing card deck and indicate the meanings of those cards in general and offer my own interpretations of how those could be read in actual practice. My playing card this month was the Seven of Diamonds. This card is a seven, which in my system of reading generally refers to a pinnacle card, a sort of peak or turning point within its suit that essentially represents an extreme element of that suit's tendencies. Since the diamonds focus on luck, money, and communication, the Seven of Diamonds is a sort of dark reading of that, connected to lies, falsehoods, and deceit. It's getting luck by devious means, cheating, and using language to manipulate. Now that largely seems negative, of course, although it's very worth noting that there are times when we have to use our language carefully to ensure we avoid causing harm or to help get our best possible outcomes. Not revealing a friend's trusted secret, or personal information, for example, may require some clever wordplay, which might be the case if you draw this card along with a Jack of Clubs and or a Four of Diamonds. Or it may indicate that someone is intentionally misleading you, too, if you pulled it with a card like the Jack of Spades. It's definitely a card that works best in context, so make sure that you incorporate that context into your reading. The tarot card this month was the Five of Swords. The natural counterpart to the Seven of Diamonds would be the Seven of Swords, but the Five of Swords also has some affinity with it, especially since it can be a bit subtler and have more shades of meaning to it. The Five of Swords often depicts someone collecting swords after what appears to have been a battle, with one or more people walking away in the distance, while the colorful foreground figure holds two swords and is collecting a third. Two others are still prone on the ground, indicating that ultimately swords were dropped or laid down, and the motley dress of our key figure may indicate that he is a fool or a jester, and used the power of wit to end the battle before it had even begun. For some, this is a card of defeat and loss, and for others, a card of sneakiness. However, it's also a card that indicates finding solutions for problems that avoid direct conflict. Resolving differences with words can be tricky business, and a card like the Five of Swords, paired with something like the Queen of Swords, might be saying that it would be helpful to seek out negotiation and use your words to gain advantages, rather than draw out or deepen a conflict at this time. Our folk divination method of the month, the Red Book, a contemporary bibliomancy game. If you're like me, you may believe that many of the answers to our most burning questions can be found in a good book. One form of occult play that takes this belief to its most literal conclusions is the practice of bibliomancy. In its simplest form, this is just the practice of asking a question, opening a book, and picking a passage at random as the answer. This form of divination has persisted for a very long time. Jewish folklore historian Joshua Trachtenberg noted that the familiar use of scripture in divining, bibliomancy, was not unknown to the Jews. The Romans had thus employed Virgil, and the Bible was already put to this use by Christians before the 8th century. In medieval germ hymn and prayer books, they served the same purpose. But Jews did not have to borrow this device from their neighbors. In Talmudic times, it was common practice to ask children what verses they had studied that day in school and accept them as good or bad omens, an expedient that persisted through the Middle Ages. As Trachtenberg says, religious books frequently became the first texts used in this practice. Partly that may have to do with their ubiquity, since most of the widely printed and available books are texts like the Bible, Talmud, and Quran. There's also a good reason that young people experimenting with this form of occult play might choose a holy book. It's very easy to claim one's just studying scripture rather than seeking out answers from beyond. And indeed, many who use bibliomancy may perceive the answers they get as divinely guided rather than anything occult in nature. Still, this method has found a home with people of all faiths or non-faiths, and is seen as a relatively harmless way of seeking answers, guiding minor decisions, and so forth. Yet there are also some significantly more occult forms of bibliomancy worth mentioning. One is the game known as Juego del Libro Rojo, or the Red Book Game. This one is a contemporary version of bibliomancy that seems to have spread widely through social media and sites specializing in creepypasta, or internet-based spooky legends and lore. Most posts attribute its origins to Mexico, although it may originate in another Spanish-speaking country, and only have gained popularity in Mexico once the internet became widely available there. To play this game, you would need a group of people, a candle, preferably red, and a book with a red cover and few to no pictures in it, hardback preferred. The method: the group should prepare the room by removing any distractions, turning off all phones, and so forth. Then they must form a circle and get the book and the candle out. The candle should be lit and placed in the center of the circle on a heatproof surface and with a way to smother the flame close to hand, preferably. The book being used needs to have a red cover, and most versions of the game indicate that it should have no pictures in it, although small illustrations or page embellishments like chapter, heading, art are fine. Each person then asks permission to play the game, saying, red book, may I play your game? Or, red book, may I come in? They will then flip open the book and put their finger down without looking at the page first. Then they read word by word, sentence by sentence, the passage where their finger landed, and the group decides whether the book has given them permission to play. This continues around the entire circles, but players should pay attention to the order in which people are accepted into the game. Players who are not immediately accepted can try again, although some variations indicate that they should only do so up to 3 times, and if they're still not allowed, they should then leave the room until the game is over. Once everyone's in, the first person to have been accepted will take the book and act as the oracle for the last person accepted. The last person accepted then asks their question, and the first person accepted will then open the book randomly and point to a passage and read it aloud. Everyone will then interpret the passage as an answer to the question. The book then passes to the second person accepted, and the first person accepted gets to ask their question, and so on until everyone has had a chance to ask at least one question. Once everyone has had a chance to ask a question or two or more, they must again go around and ask permission, this time to leave the game. Once again, each person takes the book to themselves and asks, red book, may I leave your game, or something similar, then opens to a random passage to see if they've been granted permission. If so, they are done. If not, they pass the book to the next person and wait for a chance to exit when the book comes around again. Every player must receive permission to exit, however. Creepypasta lore makes it seem as though there will be dire consequences if anyone tries to leave the game without getting permission. If you give this one a go, we would love to hear how it works out for you. If you ever get to quit playing it, that is. A Witch's Words. which is proverb of the month. Being rich is not about how much money you have or how many homes you own. It's the freedom to buy any book you want without looking at the price and wondering if you can afford it. From John Waters, filmmaker, author, and all-around fun guy, from his book Role Models. And I should note that we almost went with Waters' slightly less safer work quote about what to do if you go home with someone and find out they don't have books. But I'll let you look that one up yourselves. Our folktale this month is actually a poem in ballad form by Robert Southey called Cornelius Agrippa from 1798. Cornelius Agrippa went out one day. His study he locked ere he went away. And he gave the key of the door to his wife and charged her to keep it locked on her life. And if anyone asks my study to see, I charge you to trust them not with this key. Whoever may beg and entreat and implore, on your life let nobody enter that door. There lived a young man in the house who in vain access to that study had sought to obtain. And he begged and prayed these books to see, till the foolish woman gave him the key. On the study table a book there lay, which Agrippa himself had been reading that day. The letters were written with blood therein, and the leaves were made of dead men's skin. And these horrible leaves of magic between were the ugliest pictures that ever were seen, the likeness of things too foul to behold, that what they were is not fit to be told. The young man, he began to read. He knew not what, but he would proceed, when there was heard a sound at the door, which as he read on grew more and more and more and more. The knocking grew. The young man knew not what to do, but trembling in fear he sat within till the door was broke and the devil came in. Two hideous horns on his head he had got, like iron heated 9 times red hot. The breath of his nostrils was brimstone blue, and his tail like a fiery serpent grew. "What wouldst thou with me?" the wicked one cried. But not a word the young man replied. Every hair on his head was standing upright, and his limbs like a palsy shook with affright. "What wouldst thou with me?" cried the author of ill. But the wretched young man was silent still. Not a word his lips had the power to say, and his marrow seemed to be melting away. "What wouldst thou with me?" the third time he cries, and a flash of lightning came from his eyes, and he lifted his griffin claw in the air, and the young man had not the strength for a prayer. His eyes red fire and fury dart, as out he tore the young man's heart. He grinned a horrible grin at his prey, and in a clap of thunder vanished away. The moral: henceforth let all young men take heed how in a conjurer's books they read. Book Review: The Art of the Grimoire by Owen Davies. A few months back, I reviewed Owen Davies' book Grimoires, A History of Magic Books, first published by Oxford Press in 2009. While that makes it a slightly older book at this point, and saying that sentence makes my heart turn to dust, it's a wonderfully useful book for anyone interested in the history of magical text making. Davies is a historian and a professor of social history at the University of Hertfordshire. He's written numerous books on the forms and uses of popular magic, which is a sort of combination of folk magic and specialized service magic known by professionals called cunning folk in England and by other names in other places. Grimoires is a very accessible history of the long tradition of writing magic down for posterity, tracking those practices from the ancient world into the 12th century in mass market presses. This time, though, I'm looking at The Art of the Grimoire, written also by Davies and published by Yale University Press in 2023, which acts as a sort of visual companion for the older text. It provides hundreds of wonderful illustrations and images taken from the pages of grimoires both widely known and more obscure. The many papyri that get brief mentions in grimoires get a full visual treatment in The Art of, and artifacts like incantation bowls, which we've mentioned before, and woodblocks used for printing Buddhist magical texts are displayed in full color in this book. Throughout, Davies provides thorough context and explanation for the movement and change we see in these magic books over time. He explores how the boom in alchemy shaped new ideas about how to notate elements and chemicals in grimoires, and sees the outsized impact that grimoire sales had on cheap paperbacks from the 19th and 20th centuries. This is a book that is really powered by the image of grimoires rather than the text within them. And that is a very important piece of what makes these books of magic so, well, magical. Many of the grimoires we can pick up as paperbacks on our local witchy shop's bookshelves were once unique hand-copied items with numerous artistic and personal embellishments. Other grimoires only circulated in limited editions, lending an air of exclusivity to them. Still, others were mass-produced, but even those could carry an air of the occult, and just having them on your bookshelves could be enough to make others wonder whether you were a little odd. Davies documents these many iterations of grimoires and magical artifacts associated with them with loving detail, and this book will introduce you to familiar favorites and fascinating new tomes to seek out as well. So beware buying this book if you are watching your book budget. If you're a fan of the Tashin series of books on astrology, witchcraft, magic, etc., that use art as a way to follow the intellectual trends in occult studies over time, there will be more than enough to love in Davies' Art of the Grimoire. Materia Magica. The sixth and seventh books of Moses. Did you know that there are some books that are magical talismans entirely unto themselves? Many people have heard stories of people carrying Bibles in their pockets that stop bullets in a miraculous moment, or perhaps seen Hollywood accounts of lost manuscripts that were purportedly written by the devil himself, looking at you, the ninth gate. But even mass-marketed print books could develop quite the reputation for magical miscreancy. One of the best-known examples of a book whose mere existence seemed magical was a collection of texts that began circulating widely in the 18th century claiming to be the sixth and seventh books of Moses. In some Hebrew traditions, it was widely accepted, at least at a folk level, that the author of the Torah, the first five books of the traditional Hebraic scripture known in post-Christian eras as the Pentateuch, or the first five books of the Old Testament, was the chosen prophet and liberator, Moses. Given that the stories around Moses often also involve magical workings such as parting a sea, transforming a staff into a snake, and summoning some very pesky frogs, insects, and heavy metal angels, he is sometimes seen as a sort of wizard or magician in folk belief. During the 18th century, several books purporting to be additional texts appeared in print. Funnily enough, the oldest one we have evidence of claimed to be the 8th Book of Moses, which had its own small heyday as a celebrated grimoire. But soon after, we find editions of a text claiming to be the 6th and 7th books of Moses circulating. Remarkably, these weren't heavy tomes secreted away in distant monasteries, but rather cheaply produced books taking advantage of the ever-expanding market for inexpensive broadsides, pamphlets, and books. Early editions were in German, although they would go on to be translated into multiple languages. The books themselves provide a bit of an expanded history of Moses, but mostly focus on what is seen as ancient Hebrew magic, and provide incantations, seals, charms, and spells to gain riches, find love, and do all other manner of magical workings. The grimoire contents themselves are valuable to those studying magic, of course, but even owning and reading the book was seen as having power. For example, in Pennsylvania German communities, anyone possessing the 6th and 7th books was thought to be just an imp's breath away from diabolical involvement. A Braucher, or powwow practitioner, might own a copy simply to establish that they had power, or might shun others who did own a copy as they were thought to be deriving their power from the wrong source. The book was seen as sinister and satanic for many, and there are accounts of people reading the books to themselves only to start hearing voices and seeing strange things in the house around them. People went to court for issues like divorce, and even murder in one case, because of incidents connected with these books. Even as late as the 1960s, a Lutheran minister named Kurt Koch described finding a copy of the 6th and 7th books in the possession of a teenager and accusing the poor kid of signing his soul away to the devil by putting his name in the book. Koch and his assistants promptly burned the book to invalidate the contract, apparently. Owning the book allowed one to do all sorts of magical works, ranging from treasure hunting to placing curses that could only be undone by reading free the hexed individual, by finding the passage used to lay the curse in the books and then reading it backwards. Today, as in the 18th century, the 6th and 7th books are ubiquitous enough to be purchasable in most occult bookstores and even on the occasional newsstand, in the junk shop, or even at a gas station. Picking up a copy probably won't get you haunted or endow you with eerie powers, but if you happen to grab a copy with your pack of Twizzlers, we certainly won't tell. Creature Corner. Kyorinrin. Our creature this time is the Kyorinrin, one of the many thousands of Japanese spirits known as yokai. These are sorts of everyday spirits found in numerous places and can range from the mischievous trickster fox spirits known as the kitsune to a spirit whose claim to fame is that it likes to lick your ceiling, known as the tenjoname. Some yokai simply are, existing as spirits based in nature or as part of a larger cosmology of kami, or divine spirits, and lesser entities. But there's also a distinct line of yokai called tsukomogami, which are common objects that eventually become sentient. This frequently happens because of age. Many achieve spiritual life after surviving 100 years, for example, or through disuse and neglect. We'll surely revisit a few of those in notebooks over time, but today's tsukomogami is a kyorinrin, or the scholar's scroll. After a long period of disuse, basically sitting on a shelf unread, the spirit of the knowledge within those scrolls seeks out an audience. It begins to coalesce all the knowledge taken from that scroll, as well as from any other scholarly materials around it, and take on a form. The most common form is something like a dragon, decorated with many scrolls and tassels all over its body, signifying its great wisdom. They wear the scrolls unwound and wrapped around them like scarves or a kimono, and they have long arms they can use to reach and grab those who've left them on the shelves for so very long unattended. In more modern tellings, it's not just scrolls that take on this Kyorinrin life force. Books can also produce this sort of yokai after a long period of neglect. Funnily, there's a Japanese practice called Sundoku, which basically means that you collect more books than you could ever hope to read in a lifetime simply because having them brings you joy or peace. Which might also be a way of tapping into the spirit of this yokai, but if you happen to have some books that have been collecting dust for a while, it may be time to brush them off, give them a loving perusal, and assuage your nascent Kyorinrin before it decides that you need a sterner lesson. There's no listener email for this month. We didn't actually get anything new this month, and I haven't had a chance to go back through old comments or older email messages, so I apologize for that. But we're going to wrap it there for this month and bring our Folk Magician's Notebook to a close. As always, we are grateful for you sticking around listening. And again, sorry about the delay on getting this one out. Hopefully still useful to you. Hopefully still some fun stuff in here. Did sort of a book theme for this one and had it, honestly, largely written well in advance, but just time got away from me, so I apologize for that. But if you have thoughts on this episode or any other, please feel free to email me. Let me know what you're thinking. I'd love to hear from you. compassandkey@gmail.com or newworldwitcherypodcast@gmail.com. Both of those will get to me. You can also stop by our website, www.newworldwitchery.com, where you can find hundreds of articles on North American folk magic, all sorts of other fun stuff there too, links to all of our old podcast episodes, all kinds of good stuff. Just lots and lots of stuff is available there, so please feel free to stop by and check that out. It's also where you can go to the Find Us page on that website and get to all of our social media, Instagram, Facebook, I think it's maybe on there, YouTube, all that sort of stuff is there, so please check that out. And if you feel like giving us some support and you have a little extra change in your pocket, you can stop by patreon.com/newworldwitchery and drop a dollar a month or whatever you can into our hat. Get access to our Discord server, get access to some other cool extra stuff that we're doing. We're going to have some, I think this year's zine will be coming along somewhat soon, so maybe see that coming through at some point here. Just all kinds of other really cool stuff. So definitely would love to have you aboard if you're interested. So. I think that'll about do it for us this time around. If you have thoughts, we'd love to hear from you. But until next month, thank you again for your patience. And as always, thanks for listening. Be well.